It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about the economic power of beercations for places with small craft breweries. First, we take a look at some of the week's top stories in national politics. Confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh are in their second day. Arizona's governor announced a replacement for the late Senator John McCain. And President Trump is again criticizing Attorney General Jeff Sessions for Justice Department prosecutions of Republicans, but he hasn't moved to fire him. We want to hear what you think about the tension between President Trump and Attorney General Sessions at 800-642-1234. Do you think the president will fire Attorney General Sessions or should fire him? Do you think Sessions would or should resign? Are you concerned about the president's criticism of the Justice Department, especially amidst the Mueller investigation? If you're a supporter of President Trump, how do you feel about the job Attorney General Sessions is doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. Sabrina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the confirmation hearings at the U.S. Senate. Democratic senators sought to delay the beginning of the hearings because of records. There were some protesters disrupting the opening remarks. Today, it's the question and answer time. What have been some of the hot issues so far today?
Well, Brett Kavanaugh has been questioned on issues ranging from abortion to gun control and, of course, presidential powers, which is much more relevant given the backdrop of a special counsel investigation. He's also been asked questions about environmental policy and some of the Obama-era regulations that have been overturned by the Trump administration. So it's been very wide-ranging. The tone has been more congenial today after yesterday's attempts to delay the hearing by Democrats. Much like Neil Gorsuch, the president's previous nominee to the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh hasn't offered a great deal of information in terms of what his actual legal views are on some of these big ticket issues, most importantly, abortion.
Let's key in first on that executive power issue. Kavanaugh was asked about the president's power to pardon himself and to ignore a subpoena. Here's a listen to a question from Senator Dianne Feinstein.
You can't give me an answer on whether a president has to respond to a subpoena from a court of law?
My understanding is that you're asking me to give my view on a potential hypothetical, and that's something that each of the eight justices currently sitting on the Supreme Court, when they're sitting in my seat, declined to decide potential hypothetical cases.
And this is something we see pretty often in these confirmation hearings. Senator wants to know how they view a certain issue. A nominee says hypothetical, can't talk about that, right?
Yes, a lot of his responses have been couched in the fact that these are hypotheticals. And the challenge, I think, for Kavanaugh is that when it comes to questions around executive powers, it's not really a hypothetical. If you look at the ways in which the president has sought to undermine Robert Mueller's investigation and very real questions as to whether the president might try to pardon himself or some of his associates who have been indicted, as well as what would happen if the president was delivered a subpoena. Would he have to comply? I think that Kavanaugh certainly did not want to touch some of these very controversial subjects. It's not going to do a lot, of course, to pacify concerns among Democrats, but I think that he also knows that Republicans can confirm him with a simple majority, and I don't think that Republicans are ultimately going to hinge their support for Kavanaugh on what he says about the powers of the presidency.
Another issue that you mentioned, it came up today in their questioning, abortion rights in Roe versus Wade. Here's what Kavanaugh had to say when asked about his view on that.
It is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent, which itself is an important factor to remember. And I understand the significance of the issue, the jurisprudential issue, and I understand the significance as best I can. I always try, and I do here, of the real world effects of that decision, as I try to do of all the decisions of my court and of the Supreme Court.
Is that enough to allay concerns of maybe Republicans like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, who are maybe worried about the future of Roe versus Wade?
Well, I think that what both Senators Murkowski and Collins, who have openly suggested that they would not support a nominee who is hostile to Roe v. Wade, have said is that in their meetings with Kavanaugh, he assured them that the matter was settled law. Now, in his responses today, he also spoke a great deal about the precedent of Roe v. Wade and the significance of it, I think trying to signal that he wouldn't necessarily overturn the case if it came back before the Supreme Court, but at the same time, he didn't necessarily rule that out either. And I think the challenge when a lot of these nominees talk about precedent is that the Supreme Court in this last term alone overturned decades worth of precedent. Neil Gorsuch, for example, had said during his confirmation process that he wrote an entire book on precedent, but then he ruled in favor of overturning overturning Janus. That was a decision that dealt with public sector unions, and it was a 41-year precedent that the Supreme Court overturned. So I don't think that when Kavanaugh talks about precedent that the skeptics are necessarily buying into the fact that Roe v. Wade is not very much under threat. The only decision we have that we can go by is his dissent in a D.C. Circuit Court ruling that allowed an undocumented teen to seek an abortion while in federal custody. And he was certainly very much vocal in his opposition to that. I think he knows that he doesn't want to say anything too controversial because that, of course, is something that ultimately could very much upend his confirmation process. I think abortion is very much at center stage. But again, I think he was very careful not to really signal one way or the other how he would rule if the Supreme Court did ultimately have to revisit that decision.
Given that unless something kind of weird happens, he's probably going to be confirmed. Is this still an opportunity for both parties to send messages about their party's stance on issues and maybe their potential presidential candidates in the future?
Yes, I think that you certainly saw out the gate Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. This was yesterday. Two of the potential contenders on the Democratic side want to make very clear that they were objecting to the process by which the Kavanaugh nomination, the consideration of his nomination has transpired. I think that certainly on issues such as reproductive rights, on environment, on the powers of the presidency, these are very much at the core of what progressive voters are concerned about as they head to the polls in the November midterm election. So Democrats also see this as an opportunity to shore up support within the base. I think one of the challenges for Democrats, and this is going to factor into both midterms and in the next presidential election, is that they have not been able to convince their supporters to be as focused on the judiciary, on the Supreme Court, as Republicans have. Conservatives have been very successful in really making this one of the priorities for the Republican base. And so you now are starting to see Democrats take from that same playbook, and it certainly helps that some of those on the committee also might have aspirations for higher office. So this is an opportunity for them to also take a very public stand.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian for a look at some of the top stories in national news. I want to move on from those confirmations now. There was more criticism from President Trump directed at his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. Here's the president's tweet, quoting, "Two long-running Obama-era investigations of two very popular Republican congressmen were brought to a well-publicized charge just ahead of the midterms by the Jeff Sessions Justice Department. Two easy wins, now in doubt because there's not enough time." Can you give us some background, Sabrina, what he's talking about there?
Well, the president is referring to the indictments of Chris Collins and Duncan Hunter, both Republican members of the House. Chris Collins representing New York and Duncan Hunter, California, respectively. Collins was indicted on charges of insider trading and Hunter on charges of misusing campaign funds. There are many ways in which this tweet was misleading. Certainly, these are not Obama-era investigations. In fact, both of these investigations, they really began toward the end of the Obama administration, and much of the investigative work has transpired in the first year and a half of the Trump administration. It's also, of course, very peculiar for the president to suggest that Jeff Sessions, who was one of the most conservative members of Congress, is somehow running a Justice Department that's hostile to Republicans. The Justice Department is largely run by Republican appointees. And of course, you know, when it comes to the midterms, the fact these are not necessarily going to now be two easy wins for Democrats. These are still Republican-leaning districts. They may be competitive now that the two lawmakers, incumbents, have been indicted, but I think that the president really is using this less as an opportunity to really talk about the substance of these indictments and more as an opportunity to continue and attack Jeff Sessions and frame the Justice Department as somehow biased or tainted in its reputation.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter at The Guardian, about this week's news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 about the ongoing friction between President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Do you think President Trump should fire Jeff Sessions? Do you think he will? Does this worry you, or do you think it's a good idea? How do you think things are going to play out? If you're a supporter of the president, do you think Sessions needs to go? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Sabrina Siddiqui of The Guardian, looking at this week's top stories in national politics, staying with the Jeff Sessions and President Trump story. Sabrina, some people have read that tweet as saying the president is explicitly directing the Justice Department to use political considerations in its prosecutions. And some people saying that could actually be used by the Mueller probe to prove corrupt intent in their investigations.
Yes, and I think that ultimately what has been very striking about the president and the way that he's talked about the investigation and the Justice Department is, and I mentioned this before the break, that the overarching tactic is to try and discredit the work of the special counsel, to try and suggest that there's some sort of widespread conspiracy against the president at the Justice Department and the FBI. But what that does is it overlooks the fact that Jeff Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, Christopher Wray, Robert Mueller himself, these are all longtime Republicans. And most of these people, with the exception, of course, of with the exception of the special counsel, have been appointed by the president. But ultimately what this is an effort by the president to continue and litigate this investigation in the court of public opinion, especially as his legal team remains deadlocked in whether or not to cooperate with Mueller and his probe.
Let's go to our callers now. Jim is with us in Suamico. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
Well, my comment is that the president likes people around him who do what he says, and we have an office that, to which Jeff Sessions was appointed, which is not one that placates the president, but serves the rule of law. Whether or not I voted for Donald Trump or I support Jeff Sessions, the president is trying to do harm to the rule of law by willy-nilly placing in a position someone who will be his personal protector.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Rob in Winona, Minnesota. Rob, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Rob?
Well, in a manner of speaking, weirdly, I hope that Trump acts as Sessions because it might finally reveal Trump to be who he actually is.
Rob, thanks for the call. And Sabrina, Republicans in the Senate have talked about the idea of Trump firing Sessions. There have been different messages. What kind of things have we heard?
Well, I think that the most notable development is that Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Lindsey Graham, who would be poised to take over that chairmanship if Grassley were to choose to take on another committee chairmanship when the new Congress kicks in, they've signaled openness to the president firing Jeff Sessions, although they've said that it wouldn't be possible before the midterms. I think Republican leaders have been a lot more resistant, having said that, to the idea. Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn, the top two Republicans in the Senate, they've both certainly batted down the notion that the president should remove Sessions from his job. I think that there's certainly a case to be made that It would be difficult for a replacement to get the votes, even if it was a Republican-controlled Senate. I think there would be a great deal of opposition when it comes to the confirmation process. Certainly would invite charges of obstruction of justice from Democrats in terms of the president's motivations. So there's a very real question as to whether or not a replacement can be confirmed, but it's also worth noting that the president has really tested Republicans on Capitol Hill to see what he can get away with, and so far they've been very reluctant to really pick a fight with the president. So it is an open-ended question as to whether he will, after the midterms, fire Sessions and see if Republicans actually do defy that move, or if they ultimately are willing to go along with it.
Thanks for those calls. Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian, looking at some top stories in national politics. Want to touch on a big story about a book that isn't even out yet. Bob Woodward, veteran journalist, has this book out on the inner workings of the Trump White House. We don't need to dig into everything that's come out from that so far, but what kind of reaction are you seeing? A lot of what appear to be insider stories painting a troubled picture inside the White House.
It's another striking portrait of chaos and dysfunction in the White House. And this, of course, is the second book this year to portray an administration in disarray, the first being Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. The difference, of course, is that while some questioned Michael Wolff's methodology and reporting, Bob Woodward is a widely acclaimed journalist. And the president himself has in the past praised Woodward. So the White House is having difficulty distancing itself from some of these very remarkable anecdotes in the book about the president's own advisors thinking he's a threat to national security, about the president's aides talking about him like he's likening him, his behavior, to that of a child. All they've really been able to do is issue statements saying that the book is fiction, but Woodward has said that he spoke with more than a dozen current and former administration officials and that he has recordings. So I think they know that if they really take this to too public of a level, the White House, then Woodward ultimately does have the opportunity to put out transcripts of his conversations.
I want to move on to a couple issues you've been writing on, Sabrina. The late Senator John McCain, his replacement was appointed by Arizona's governor. It's former U.S. Senator John Kyle. Can you talk about that selection?
Well, John Kyle, of course, served in the Senate himself for three terms by McCain's side. And he rose in the ranks of leadership before he retired at the end of 2012. He was the second-ranking Republican in the Senate. What's been notable about his appointment is that he has been working as a so-called Sherpa for Brett Kavanaugh. In other words, he has been guiding Brett Kavanaugh through the confirmation process for the Supreme Court. And because Republicans have just a razor-thin majority in the Senate, they can only afford to lose one vote when it comes to the Kavanaugh nomination. So they know that now that they will have the support of John Kyle. So there's been some questions as to whether this is a political appointment, especially because John Kyle also has not committed to serving beyond the end of this year, and which would then force Governor Ducey in Arizona to make another appointment in January to serve out the remainder of Senator McCain's term before a special election, which is anticipated in 2020.
And then in midterm election news, you wrote about, once again, there are questions about Nancy Pelosi and her leadership of Democrats in the House, a minority leader now, possibly a speaker if the Democrats were able to regain their majority. You start off describing a scene that could have been yesterday, but it was actually 2012, I think.
Well, yes, because this conversation comes up every 2 years or so. Is this the moment where Nancy Pelosi will be forced to step aside? Is her leadership position in danger? And that's not to say that the question has not been lingering and perhaps more potent this year. But so far, one of the challenges for those Democrats who do believe she should be replaced has been finding someone who would actually be a suitable replacement. She's a very prolific fundraiser. There's probably no one else who could bring in more than $100 million in one election cycle alone. And there's also the very real question as to whether anyone else would have the votes. After the 2016 election, she was challenged by Tim Ryan, a congressman from Ohio, And ultimately, she still was able to secure a two-thirds majority. Now, if Democrats retake the House and we're talking about the speakership, then we'll have to wait and see if there's anyone who is going to make a credible run against Pelosi. But right now, she still appears to have the support of the Democratic caucus on Capitol Hill. And even some of these candidates who have not committed to supporting her as speaker or as leader, those Democrats are on the ballot. Oftentimes they say that when they're competing in some of these races, and then they strike a very different tone when they actually arrive on Capitol Hill.
So what does it say that there's a lot of attention to potentially replacing Nancy Pelosi? On the Republican side of things, they know they're going to have to replace Paul Ryan after this round of elections because he's not coming back.
Well, that's why it's somewhat striking that the conversation is so fixated on Nancy Pelosi. And part of that speaks to the ways in which Republicans have been successful at making her the sort of villain in the midterm elections and trying to make this election a referendum on Pelosi and the Democratic establishment, when obviously the election is more likely to be a referendum on President Trump. As you know, there is going to be an open race for speaker or for leader on the Republican side, and there's very little attention being given to who the candidates are. But in some ways, I think what Republicans are doing is they're operating off the same playbook they used against Hillary Clinton, where they have someone in Nancy Pelosi who is a very polarizing figure. She also happens to be a prominent woman in power, and they have seen a way to use her in their attack ads and to try and tie Democrats to her as if she is toxic in some way. Now, the problem is that polling has shown that the attacks are not actually all that effective for Republicans, that Nancy Pelosi is not a priority for voters when they head to the polls. But I think ultimately Republicans don't want to talk about the president, and so this is what they've actually tried to hinge a lot of their attack lines on.
We'll leave it there for now. Sabrina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter at The Guardian. She was with us for a weekly roundup of national news. Wisconsin is no stranger to craft breweries with brands like New Glarus, Lakefront, and many others. But for some of the state's rural communities, a local brewery could be a lot more than just beer, with the potential to spur economic activity in places where more businesses are leaving than starting. It's thanks in part to a trend of beer tourism, where travelers plan a trip to visit a craft brewer or add a visit to their vacation itineraries when they're in a new place. Bart Watson is chief economist at the Brewers Association, a national trade group that represents craft brewers. Bart, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when we think of the economics of beer, we think of the making of the beer and then the selling of it. But tourism, how big a deal is that for the craft brewing industry?
Well, brewery tourism is a big deal, and it's something that's growing in importance. We've seen at the brewery visits grow, those direct sales grow. And increasingly, American beer lovers want to go visit the breweries that they love and taste the beer at the place where it's made.
Do we have numbers that at least give us a ballpark of how many people are doing beer tourism?
Well, we know that there are, on average, about a craft beer drinker will visit about 6 breweries a year, 3.5 near their house and 2.5 while traveling. And the estimates are there's somewhere between 50 and 60 million craft beer drinkers now. So that's adding up to, you know, millions and millions of trips a year.
What is it about touring the breweries that that you think is luring people in?
Well, broadly, we've seen Americans want to drink in a more experiential fashion in recent years. And I think going to the brewery really helps that. They can learn something about the beer styles. They can see the process and how it's made. They can tour around the facility. And I think that adds to the enjoyment of the beer itself in the glass.
Do you see a lot of brewers kind of designing their facilities with not just production in mind, but with the idea that, okay, how can we take people through here?
Certainly, most of the facilities designed in the last few years have been designed with visitors in mind. That wasn't something that was, you know, perhaps the case a few years ago, but I think brewers are increasingly recognizing that this is a great way to market their brands, to welcome people into their breweries, and have them drink the beers in a great environment.
Let's talk about now rural and small town America. There are economic concerns in a lot of those places, and I think you quoted saying that this is kind of a natural match. Brewers have a lot of good advantages when they look to open up in smaller towns.
You know, it can be a great match. You know, brewers love having more space available. You know, it's still a manufacturing business, and small towns often have, you know, cheaper real estate and more space available. It can also be something that gets people to those towns. You know, not every brewery is going to attract out-of-town visitors, but many can get people to get in the car, to drive, to travel, and come out and have a few beers and visit the brewery.
Are there places in the country that you point to where rural America has really benefited from having those craft breweries?
Well, this is something where it's a national phenomenon, so I don't think there's one specific place, but it's happening all over the country. 80% of Americans now live within 10 miles of a brewery, so this isn't something that happens in one particular city or town or one region, but you know, we're seeing in rural areas across the country.
I've seen people say this is kind of like going back to the past in some ways. Once upon a time, it was the thing. You had the brewery, maybe not in your town, but in your region, certainly. We moved away from that. And now it's coming back.
It is. We're seeing an increase in drinking local. People are increasingly interested in being connected to what they're drinking. They want to support small and independent local brewers. And while we now have the most breweries we've ever had in the United States, it's not quite at the per capita levels in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So there's perhaps still room to grow to get back to that, you know, local brewery mentality.
That's something I wanted to ask about, because I've seen people wonder, are we, you know, hitting peak beer or peak craft beer? And now this is a question I've seen asked this year and 5 years ago and 15 years ago. Is there an oversaturation point that you worry about, though?
I think this is something you really have to look at market by market. You know, nationally, I think there's still certainly room to grow, but that doesn't mean that every place is going to be able to support more breweries. And because so many of these breweries are very small and locally focused, 75% of the breweries in the country collectively make less than 1% of the beer. Then, you know, it's really going to depend on the local market to see whether we're at saturation point or not.
Talking to Bart Watson, chief economist at the Brewers Association, about craft beer, beer tourism, and especially in rural and small town America, how it's affecting the economy there. Bart, I've seen some brewers quoted as saying, hey, if we're out in rural America, well, that makes it easier for us to locally source at least some of our supplies. Is that something you're seeing pop up more and more?
Certainly. And that's, you know, one of the parts of this brewery tourism in rural places is that can be combo of agritourism, you know, in areas of the country where the climate is you know, able to do so. You can grow hops on the property. You can grow barley. Not a lot of brewers are doing their own malting per se, but you can maybe grow some of the fruits if you're making fruit beers. And that certainly adds to the overall atmosphere. And this is something that I think a lot of people are familiar with. I mean, wine tourism and tasting is something that we've long had as a country, and beer's really caught up in recent years.
Can you talk about brewery startups a little bit as they want to go into a rural area? I know some people make the transition from being a home brewer to larger scale craft brewing, but how big a barrier to entry is there for somebody getting into this industry?
There still certainly are barriers to entry. A lot of those are going to be regulatory or are going to vary state to state or locality to locality. It's also a capital intensive business, so depending on the scale you're looking at, it can require a decent amount of money to build out. But, you know, we're seeing with the record number of openings that there are still lots of people interested in getting involved, and certainly something that if you're passionate about and willing to face a competitive market that you can enter.
Now, here in Wisconsin, I think it's fair to say we think of ourselves as pretty good at making beer. Looking at us from the national landscape, though, are people seeing Wisconsin as a destination for seeking out great beer, maybe hitting the road and doing some tourism related to beer?
Certainly, Wisconsin's one of the states with a long brewing tradition, and I think its current crop of breweries have certainly kept that up. You know, there's a number of breweries in Wisconsin that, you know, only distribute in Wisconsin, New Glarus being the most famous, which can lead people to come into the state to not only visit but to buy those beers. And so I think along with a lot of places in the United States, Wisconsin has developed an industry that's worth visiting.
Getting back to tourism a little bit, what kind of things do we see? Is it, okay, we're going to hop in the car, go to that brewery an hour away and take a tour? Or are people really planning, hey, a week-long trip, let's get out the map, let's map out the breweries and check a whole bunch out?
Certainly not everyone is going just to visit breweries. Maybe they're going to visit a town for another reason and they're stopping into the local brewery. But increasingly, we see people focused on going to breweries specifically. You know, they have a plan where they want to go to a particular place or maybe a particular festival. Wisconsin hosts the Great Taste of the Midwest in Madison every year, and lots of people from out of state make it a, you know, part of their summer to come in and visit and drink some of the local beer.
Now, people going into the beer business, I imagine they're thinking mostly about the beer, and that's the big part of their business plan. What are some ways that a brewer, especially a new one, can start to tap into that tourism market? Because that might not be on their radar.
Well, I think certainly it starts with, you know, having great beer. You know, if you don't have beer that is going to differentiate itself in a crowded marketplace, you're probably not going to get people moving off the beaten path to come visit you. But I think it also is about the experience. Are you building an environment that, you know, is going to take people, you know, out of their daily lives for a few minutes as they drink a beer and, you know, sit in your tasting room, you know, selecting a location that they want to visit. So, you know, more and more brewers are thinking about this as part of their business model, as part of their plan. And really building it in as something that they're striving for along with that great beer.
Now, looking at the beer industry as a whole, are there trends that you're seeing from your position with the Brewers Association in the kinds of beers that are hitting the market lately?
Well, we certainly have seen, you know, a continued shift toward hoppier beers. The most popular craft style is India Pale Ale, which is a fairly hoppy beer. But that pendulum is also swinging back a little bit, where a lot of craft brewers are now making, you know, lighter style beers, Pilsners, Kolsches, Golden Ales. Those are the styles that have long dominated the U.S. beer industry. We generally drink a lot of lagers here in the United States. But generally, we're just seeing a lot of experimentation, innovation. Sour beers are gaining in popularity. So, you know, if you're interested in getting into beer, there's probably a style that you'll find that you'll like.
And you mentioned those hops. And I know I've talked to people on this show about efforts to kind of restore Wisconsin as a hops producer. Are you seeing that as we get craft breweries around the country, that people are not only, you know, going to farmers to buy, you know, locally produced grains, but actually kind of restore that production cycle for hops and other key ingredients?
Hops have traditionally been dominated by three states in the Pacific Northwest, but we are seeing more states starting to build local hop industry. It takes a lot of time, money, and effort. The infrastructure for hops is significant. But certainly a state like Wisconsin would be well poised given its geography. Michigan right next door is the fourth leading state for hops in the United States. And as more brewers are interested in incorporating local ingredients into their beers, it's only natural that they'd be looking to source from local farmers, and that industry would be able to develop as a result.
I've toured a brewery or two, Bart. Can you sell kind of the general beer drinking public on what's fun about actually going and seeing where the product is made?
Well, I think what's great is that you can really engage with the brewer. They can find out what you're interested in, what you like to drink, maybe outside of beer, and really find something that you're going to like. There's an incredible range of styles that brewers are brewing now. And so going, being there, seeing what they're making, hearing their story, you're going to feel a connection to the beers and to that locality that you might not if you're just going and picking up a six-pack at the supermarket.
It's a good place to leave it. Bart, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Bart Watson, chief economist with the Brewers Association, a national trade group that represents craft breweries. He was with us to talk about how beer tourism impacts local economies. A growing number of Democratic candidates for office are pledging to refuse donations from corporate political action committees, or PACs. The trend has spread beyond the party's most progressive members, with moderate candidates and even some presidential hopefuls getting on board. But refusing donations from corporate PACs doesn't necessarily mean money from corporations won't go to those campaigns, and making a no-PAC pledge might be more symbolic than practical. Elaine Godfrey is an assistant editor and political reporter for The Atlantic. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you see this growing trend among Democratic candidates, especially for Congress, refusing to accept money from these corporate political action committees. How common is this getting?
It's getting pretty common. I mean, so you have all of these new candidates, the ones that there's tons of buzz about, right? Like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, Ayanna Pressley, who just won last night in Massachusetts, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, even Randy Bryce in Wisconsin running in Paul Ryan's district. You know, that's just a few of them. It's becoming more and more common. There's 185 Democratic candidates right now, I think, who've made the pledge, and I think that it's becoming common, and it's important to understand what they mean when they say
right.
that they'll be issuing corporate PAC donations.
Right. Let's talk about that. This is one mm-hmm. very specific type of political action committee, these corporate PACs. Can you talk about what that is? What candidates say they're not taking?
Right. Okay. So there are basically three main categories of PACs. PACs, right? There's ideological PACs, there's labor PACs, and then there's corporate PACs. And corporate PACs are basically, it's money donated by employees of a company given to a candidate in the name of that company. So, you know, JP Morgan has a corporate PAC and their employees donate to it if they want. And they can give up to $5,000 to an individual candidate per election cycle. But this is not the same as a super PAC, right, which is the PACs that everyone's heard about, which can raise unlimited money but can't donate to candidates directly. They can just sort of, you know, they could run an attack ad against Randy Bryce, for example, but they couldn't support him directly.
So that's one way I could, if I'm a candidate, I could say I'm not taking this corporate PAC money. Super PACs could still spend on my behalf in some ways. Also, as I understand it from your piece on this, I could still take money from individuals who work for that corporation.
Right, exactly. So this is one of the big criticisms here is that, you know, Super PAC, you don't have a ton of control over what they can do because they're not giving to you directly. So you can't, these candidates aren't telling them, basically, don't give to me. They're still accepting that help in indirect ways. And then, you know, they might not take corporate PAC money. But, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won't take corporate PAC money from J.P. Morgan, right? But an employee recently gave her the maximum individual donation, $2,700. So you could get individual donations from those companies. You could get, you know, a donation from the CEO, for example, of any company.
So we're still not talking about $0 here. How much might a candidate be giving up on if they say, okay, no, I'm not going to take money from these corporate PACs?
Right. So it's really not a significant amount. For non-incumbent candidates running, so candidates like Randy Bryce, candidates like Ayanna Pressley, they're only maybe 400 this year out of 3,000 candidates running who've taken corporate PAC money. So, you know, just over 10%. And then for incumbents, so you have a few 2020 contenders like Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, who've made this pledge also, who've sort of jumped on this no PAC money trend, no corporate PAC money trend, I should say. It's not a huge part of their campaign contributions either. So Gillibrand, over her entire career, only about 9% of her contributions have been from corporate PACs. For Kamala Harris, it's less than 2%.
So talk about the symbolic value then of candidates, almost exclusively, not completely exclusively, Democrats saying, yeah, we're not going to take this one kind of corporate money.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard because, you know, other Democrats and conservatives, of course, are saying, well, it's easy to cut off this source of funding if you're not really getting a lot anyway. But the progressives I spoke with said, yeah, you know, that's right. It's pretty symbolic, but it's a first step to reforming the campaign finance system that, you know, voters seem to be hungry for addressing that, right? Like, this has become a growing concern for voters. Corruption, money in politics. And I think it helps progressives move closer to that goal of reforming the campaign finance system that we have. It doesn't really, you know, it is mostly symbolic, but it does help them move closer, and it helps progressives differentiate themselves to voters. So it's sort of a little bit of both.
Talking to Elaine Godfrey with The Atlantic about a growing number of Democratic candidates saying they're not going to take a particular type of corporate contribution from corporate political action committees. Elaine, let's follow up on that last point, the idea that campaign finance reform is an issue that's going to resonate with voters. It's been an issue that's been out there a long time, and my sense has always been you've got some people who are really concerned about it, and it's, you know, way down the list for the bulk of voters. From the people you talk to in the political world, are they sensing that, no, this is a different time?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, we saw it in 2016, right? I mean, well, first we saw it with Obama, who ran accepting no PAC money and no money from lobbyists. And then we saw it from Donald Trump, who said, you know, I don't want to be beholden to any corporate interests, I'll self-fund, which he sort of not a promise that he fully kept, but he, you know, he appealed to voters that way. Bernie Sanders, he was all about those small donations. I think this is something we can expect to see a lot more often. So, I mean, from everyone that I spoke with, in 2020, you can bet, they told me that all Democratic candidates for president will not be taking corporate PAC money. And maybe they'll go even further. Who knows? Maybe they won't take any PAC money, or maybe they'll tell super PACs, you know, don't spend a lot to help me out. We don't know, but we do know that this talking point is definitely going to stick around.
There's the talking point of not accepting this kind of donation. Are these Democratic candidates also talking about new campaign finance reforms as part of their agenda, their platform?
Yeah, so some of them are. You know, not so much the ones that I've mentioned here, but a couple. So we have California Representative Ro Khanna has actually made this a pretty big deal in Congress. He ran in California and won, pledging not to take any corporate PAC or any money, any PAC money at all, not just corporate PAC money. And he's proposing a system called Democracy Dollars, which would essentially give every American money to donate to a campaign, ridding the country of the need for, you know, super PACs and that kind of thing. And that's really a long shot, but I do think that the more this gets talked about and, you know, the more candidates who make this pledge succeed, I mean, it's going to become more clear that legislation it could be popular, right? This could be something that is passed soon. But no, I don't think that there is a ton of talk right now about specifics.
Did you hear concern from any Democratic strategists that, okay, this is lovely, this is symbolic, but if you're in a tight race for a House seat or a U.S. Senate seat for that matter, every dollar is going to count. Don't go in with one hand tied behind your back?
Absolutely, yeah. And they tend to call this kind of thing unilaterally disarming, right? So they say, you know, Republicans are taking all the money they can get. They're not discriminating. They're in these tight races. You know, they're coming at it with all they have, and Democrats should do the same. And, you know, I talked to several Democrats who are worried about that. So, yeah, that's a big concern, right? Like, can you issue this money when you're going to need all the help you can get? Like, Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania's 18th district, when he ran in the special election this spring, that was a big concern, right? But he didn't accept corporate PAC money, and he still won. So I think progressives would hold him up as an example of, you know, if you make this promise and you're likable, you don't need that money. It's really, it doesn't matter. People will respect you for it and vote for you for that promise.
You mentioned earlier the 2020 presidential election campaign. Do you think for a significant number of Democratic core primary voters, they're going to look at their presidential candidates and use this as a litmus test, maybe not the only litmus test, for who they're going to vote for?
You know, I do. I think that this is going to be, I think if anything, you know, a candidate who still accepts corporate PAC money, even if it's more symbolic than it is anything else, it's going to signal to voters. I mean, it's going to signal something negative to voters. I don't think it will be, you know, a huge issue for them, especially because I think most voters don't really understand what that means. I think it's sort of hard to know without doing some research into that what corporate PAC money actually is. But yeah, I think it will be a litmus test going into 2020 for sure.
We'll leave it there for now. Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
Elaine Godfrey is an assistant editor and political reporter for The Atlantic. She was with us to look at the trend of Democratic politicians, including candidates for Congress, refusing money from corporate political action committees. You can let us know your thoughts on this. Is it important to you that candidates not take this particular kind of political action money? Do you think bigger campaign finance changes are needed at the federal level, or do you think we're simply just in a new age of political spending? Email ideas at WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. The U.S. Open tennis tournament is going on now. There's a lot of tennis, of course, but a story about food at the event has really captured the internet's imagination. A fan was seen on camera eating, you know, chicken fingers, those little chicken tender things, and dipping them, okay, so far, dipping them into some kind of soda. Apparently it was Coca-Cola, actually. The person was later interviewed and said, yeah, I just kind of have weird food taste. It's something I do. It tastes pretty good. So, yeah. dipping the chicken into Coke and eating the chicken. And now a lot of people around the world were shocked and appalled at the idea. Some Australian news site said, you know, person seen dipping chicken tenders in Coke, put her in prison. It's maybe a little extreme, especially when you consider. Now, I started searching for this, and I tried searching for recipes involving Coca-Cola and chicken. Here are some of the titles. Coca-Cola Chicken Barbecue, Grilled Chicken with Cola Sauce, Coke Brined Grilled Chicken Cola Marinade, Grilled Cola Chicken, Grilled Cola Barbecue Chicken, Easy Cola Chicken Recipe, Coyote's Coke Can Chicken. That's from the Coca-Cola company itself. So apparently somebody out there thinks chicken and Coke taste pretty well together. Just dipping in liquid, though, is maybe where we're going wrong, because that seems like it's going to loosen up the batter and make it soggy. But maybe there's something to it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.